too. We'll both live to see them again, Major.
Well, probably.
And when our bombers attack you?
That happened 3 hours ago.
Didn't anyone tell you?
Ha! The first time!
I was on Nimitz. We took two hits. Toland described the attack briefly.
This time things worked out differently. We're conducting rescue operations now. You'll know for sure when we bring some survivors in.
Your Air Force is no longer a threat to us.
Submarines are another matter, but there is no sense asking a fighter pilot about that.
In fact, this isn't really an interrogation.
So, why are you here?
I will be asking you some questions later. I just wanted to come down and say hello.
Is there anything I can get you? Anything you need?
Chapayev did not know what to make of this. Aside from the possibility the Americans would shoot him outright, he didn't know what to expect. He'd had the usual lectures about trying to escape, but clearly these did not apply to being aboard a ship in the middle of the ocean.
"I do not believe you," he said finally.
"Comrade Major, there is no point in asking you about the MiG-29 because none are left on Iceland. All the others in the Soviet Air Force are in Central Europe, but we're not going there. There is no point in asking you about ground defense positions on Iceland. You're a pilot, and you don't know anything about that. The same is true of the remaining threat against us, submarines."
"What do you know about submarines, eh?"
"Think, Major. You are an educated man. Do you think you have information that we need?"
"I doubt it."
"You will be exchanged in due course for our prisoners. A political question for our political masters. Until then, we will treat you properly."
Toland paused.
"Talk to me, Major."
"I'm hungry," Chapayev said after a moment. "Dinner should be in about 30 minutes.
"You will just send me home after—"
"We don't have labor camps, and we don't kill prisoners. If we were going to mistreat you, why did the surgeon sew up your leg and prescribe pain medications?"
"The pictures I had with me?"
"Almost forgot." Toland handed the Russian's wallet over.
"Isn't it against the rules to take this up with you?"
"I carry it for luck," he said. Chapayev pulled out the black-and-white shot of his wife and twin daughters.
"I will see you again. It may be some months, but I will see you again."
Bob chuckled.
"It worked, Comrade Major."
"Here are mine."
"Your wife is too skinny, but you are a lucky man also."
Chapayev paused as his eyes teared up for a moment. He blinked them away.
"I would like a drink," he said hopefully.
"Me too. Not allowed on our ships." He looked at the photos.
"Your daughters are beautiful, Major."
"You know, we have to be crazy to leave them."
"We have our duty," Chapayev said.
Toland gestured angrily. "It's the damned politicians. They just tell us to go. And we go like idiots. Hell, we don't even know why the goddamned war started."
"You mean you do not know?"
Bingo. Codeine and sympathy. The tape recorder he had in his pocket was already turned on. Hunson, Federal Republic of Germany. "If I continue the attack, we'll be destroyed here," Alexeyev protested. "I have two full divisions on my flank, and I have a report that American tanks are at Alfeld."
"Impossible," Sinkwest replied angrily.
"The report came from Major Sergeyev. He saw them arrive. I have ordered him to Stendal to make his report to you personally."
"I have 26th Motor Rifle approaching Alfeld now. If any Americans are present, they'll handle matters."
That's a Category C unit, Alexeyev thought. Reservists, short on equipment, out-of-date training.
"What progress have you made on the crossing?"
"Two regiments across, a third moving now. Enemy air activity has picked up. Damn it, I have enemy units in my rear."
Get back to Stendal, Pasha. Beregavoy is in command at Hunson. I need you here.
I'm being relieved. I'm being relieved of my command.
Understood, Comrade General, Alexeyev replied.
He switched off the radio.
Can I leave my troops this vulnerable to counterattack? Can I forego warning, my commanders?
Alexeyev slammed his fist on the work table.
Get me General Beregavoy.
Alfeld, Federal Republic of Germany. It was too far for artillery support from the NATO lines, and they'd been forced to leave their own guns behind. McCall trained his gun sights through the haze and saw the advancing Russian formations. He estimated 2 regiments. That made it a division-sized attack in the classic 2-up, 1-back fashion. I don't see any SAM launchers up front. The colonel in overall command started giving his orders over the command circuit. Friendly air was coming in. Apache attack choppers popped up right behind the CAV's positions. They moved south to flank the advancing Russian vehicles, jinking and skidding as they launched their Hellfire missiles into the leading echelon of tanks. Their pilots sought out missile launch vehicles, but found none. Next came the A-10s. The ugly twin-engine aircraft swooped low, free for once of the SAM threat. Their rotary cannon and cluster bombs continued the job of the Apaches.
They're coming in dumb, boss, the gunner commented. Maybe they're green, Woody.
Okay by me.
The Bradleys on the eastern edge of the town engaged next with their missiles. The leading Soviet ranks were savaged even before they came into range of the tanks over the river. The attack began to falter. The Russian tanks stopped to shoot. They popped smoke and shot wildly from inside it. A few wild rounds landed close to McCall's position, but they were not aimed shots. The attack was stopped 2 kilometers short of the town.
Head north, Alexeyev said over the headset.
Comrade General, if we head north, the pilot started to say.
I said head north.
Keep low, he added. The heavily armed Mi-24 swooped low abruptly. Alexeyev's gorge rose in his throat as the pilot tried to get even with him for giving the stupid, dangerous order. He sat in the back, hanging on to the seatbelt and leaning out the left side door to see what he could. The helicopter jinked violently left and right, up and down. The pilot knew the dangers here.
There, Alexeyev called. 10 o'clock. I see. American or German? Tanks at 10 o'clock.
I see some missile vehicles, too, Comrade General. Do you wish to see them more closely? The pilot inquired acidly.
He brought the chopper down a wooded road, barely 2 meters above the pavement, as he dipped out of sight.
That was at least a battalion, the general said.
I'd say more, the pilot commented. He was at full power, his nose low for maximum speed, and his eyes scanned ahead for enemy aircraft.
The general fumbled with his map. He had to sit down and strap in to use both hands on it.
My God, this far south?
As I told you, the pilot answered over the intercom, they have staged a breakthrough.
How close can you go to Alfeld?
That depends on how much the general wishes to be alive tonight.
Alexeyev noted the fear and anger in the words, and reminded himself that the captain flying this helicopter was already twice a hero of the Soviet Union for his daring over the battlefield.
As close as you think safe, Comrade Captain. I must see for myself what the enemy is doing.
Understood. Hang on. It will be a very rough ride.
The Mi-24 jumped up to avoid some power lines, then dropped again like a stone. Alexeyev winced at how close to the ground they stopped.
Enemy aircraft overhead. Looked like the Devil's Cross. 4 of them heading west.
They passed over not a road, Alexeyev thought, a grassy strip with tracked vehicles on it. The grass had been churned to bare dirt. He checked his map. This route led to Alfeld.
I will cross over the Lina and approach Alfeld from the east. That way we'll be over friendly troops if anything happens, the pilot advised.
Immediately thereafter the aircraft jumped up and down again.
Alexeyev caught a glimpse of tanks on the ridge as they raced past. Many of them. A few strings of tracer bullets reached out at the chopper but fell behind.
"Quite a few tanks there, Comrade General. I'd say a regimental force. The tank repair yard is to the south. What's left of it. Shit! Enemy helicopters to the south!"
The aircraft stopped and pivoted in the air. There was a roar as an air-to-air missile leaped off the wingtip. Then the Mi-24 started moving again. It jinked up, then down hard, and the General saw a smoke trail go overhead.
That was close.
"Did you get him?"
"Does the General wish me to stop and see?"
"What's that? That wasn't here before."
The chopper stopped briefly.
Alexeyev saw burning vehicles and running men. The tanks were old T-55s. This was the counterattack he'd been told about. Smashed! A minute later, he saw vehicles assembling for another effort.
"I've seen enough. Straight to Stendal as fast as you can."
The General leaned back with his maps and tried to formulate a clear picture of what he'd seen. Half an hour later, the helicopter flared and landed.
"You were right, Pasha," Cinquest said as soon as he walked into the operations room.
He held three reconnaissance photographs.
26th Motor Rifles' initial attack was crushed 2 kilometers in front of enemy lines. When I flew over, they were reforming for another.
"This is a mistake," Alexeyev said with quiet urgency.
"If we want that position back, we have to attack with full preparation."
"We must have that bridgehead back in our hands as quickly as possible."
"Fine. Tell Beregovoy to detach 2 of his units and drive back east."
"We can't abandon the Weser crossing."
"Comrade General, either we pull those units back, or we let NATO destroy them in place. That is the only choice we have at the moment."
"No. Once we get Alfeld back, we can reinforce. That will defeat the counterattack on their flank and allow us to continue the advance."
"What do we have to strike Alfeld with?"
3 divisions are en route now."
Alexeyev scanned the unit designations on the map.
"They're all C formations."
"Yes, I had to divert most of my B units north. NATO counterattacked at Hamburg as well."
"Cheer up, Pasha. We have many C units coming onto the front."
Wonderful. All these old, fat, out-of-practice reservists are marching to a front held by battle-seasoned troops.
"Wait until all 3 divisions are in place. Get their artillery up front first so that we can pound the NATO positions. What about Gronau?"
"The Germans crossed the line there, but we have them contained. 2 divisions are moving to attack there also."
Alexeyev walked over to the main map display and looked for changes in the tactical situation since he'd last been here. The battle lines in the north had not changed appreciably, and the NATO counterattack on the Alfeld Ruhla salient was only now being posted. Blue flags were at Gronau and Alfeld. There was the counterattack at Hamburg.
"We've lost the initiative. How do we get it back?"
The Soviet army had started the war with 20 A divisions based in Germany, with another 10 moved in at the start, and more since. All of them had now been committed to battle, many pulled off the line due to losses. The last reserve of the full-strength formations was at Ruhla, and they were about to be trapped. Beregovoy was too good a soldier to violate orders, even though he knew his forces had to be pulled back before they were irretrievably cut off.
"We must abandon the attack. If we press on, those divisions will be trapped behind 2 rivers, not just 1.
"The attack is a political and military necessity," Cinquest answered. "If they push forward, NATO will have to draw forces off this attack to defend the Ruhr. Then we'll have them."
Alexeyev didn't argue further. The thought that came to him felt like a blast of cold air on exposed skin.
Have we failed?
USS Independence.
"Admiral, I need to see somebody in the MAF.
"Who?"
"Chuck Lowe. He's a regimental commander. Before he took it over, we worked together on Sinklant's intelligence staff."
"Why not?"
"He's good, Admiral. Very good at this stuff."
"You think the information is that hot?" Jacobson asked.
"I sure do, sir, but I need a second opinion. Chuck's the best guy who's handy."
Jacobson lifted his phone.
Get me General Emerson, quick. Billy? Scott? You have a Colonel Chuck Lowe serving with you? Where? Okay, one of my intel people needs to see him right now. Important enough, Billy. Very well, he'll be on his way in 10 minutes. The Admiral set the phone down. Have you copied that tape? Yes, sir. This is one of the copies. The original's in the safe. There'll be a helo waiting for you. It was a 1-hour flight to Stikis Holmer. From there, a marine chopper took him southeast. He found Chuck Lowe in a tent looking over some maps.
You get around pretty good.
I heard about Nimitz, Bob. Glad to see you made it. What's up? I want you to listen to this tape. It'll take you about 20 minutes. Toland explained who the Russian was. He handed over a small Japanese personal tape player with earphones. The two officers walked out of the tent to a relatively quiet place. Twice, Lowe rewound the tape to repeat a section.
"Son of a bitch," he said quietly when it was finished.
"He thought we already knew." Colonel Lowe stooped down to pick up a rock. He hefted it in his hand for a moment, then hurled it as hard as he could.
"Why not? We assume the KGB is competent. Why should they assume that we're not? We had the information all along. And we blew it."
His voice was full of wonder and disgust.
"You sure this isn't a cock-and-bull story?"
"When we pulled him out of the water, he had a nasty cut on the leg. The docs sewed that up and gave him pain pills. I caught him weak from blood loss and pretty well juiced on codeine. Kind of hard to lie well when you're drunk, isn't it? Chuck, I really need your opinion."
"Trying to land me back in the intel business?"
Lowe smiled briefly.
"Bob, it makes a hell of a lot of sense. This should go up the ladder fast."
"I think Sac Yur should get it."
"You can't just call up for an appointment, Bob."
"I can go through Com East Lant. The original goes to Washington. CIA will want to use a voice stress analysis machine on it." "But I saw the man's eyes, Chuck."
"I agree. It should go to the top as fast as you can get it there. And Sac Yur can make the fastest use of it."
"Thanks, Colonel."
"How do I call the chopper back?"
"I'll handle that."
"Welcome to Iceland, by the way."
"How's it going?"
Toland followed the colonel back to the tent. "We're up against good troops, but they have a tough defensive problem here, and we have all the firepower we need. We got 'em by the ass."
The colonel paused.
"Nice work, Squid."
2 hours later, Toland was aboard a plane bound for Heathrow.
Moscow, RSFSR. The briefing was given by Marshal Fyodor Borisovich Bukharin. The KGB had arrested Marshals Shavirin and Roshkov the day before, a move that told Minister Sergeyev more than this briefing ever would. "The attack west from Alfeld has bogged down due to poor planning and execution by Commander-in-Chief West. We need to regain the initiative. Fortunately, we have the troops available, and nothing changes the fact that NATO has suffered grievous losses. I propose a replacement of the Western Theater Command staff and..."
"Wait, I wish to say something," Sergeyev interrupted.
"Make your point, Mikhail Eduardovich," the defense minister said, his annoyance clear.
"Marshal Bukharin, you propose complete staff replacement?" The practical consequences to the replacees was unspoken, Sergeyev thought, but plain enough.
"My son is on the staff of the Deputy Commander West, General Alexeyev. This general is the one who led the breakthrough at Alfeld, and the one at Rula. He's been wounded twice and had his helicopter shot down by enemy fighters, after which he commandeered a truck and raced to the front to lead yet another successful attack. He's the only effective general we have that I know of, and you want to replace him with someone unfamiliar with the situation? What madness is this?" he asked angrily.
The Minister of the Interior leaned forward.
"Just because your son is on his staff?"
Sergeyev's face went beet red.
"Just because my son, you say? My son is at the front, serving the state. He's been wounded, and barely escaped death when he was shot down at his general's side.
Who else at this table can say that, comrades? Where are your sons?
He pounded on the table in rage. Sergeyev concluded in a softer voice, wounding his colleagues in a way that mattered, really mattered.
Where are the communists here?
There was a brief but deadly silence.
Sergeyev knew that he had either ended his political career or boosted it beyond measure.
His fate would be decided by whoever spoke next.
In the great patriotic war, Pyotr Bromkovsky said with an old man's dignity, Politburo members lived at the front. Many lost sons. Even Comrade Stalin gave his sons to the state, serving alongside the sons of ordinary workers and peasants.
Mikhail Eduardovich speaks well.
Comrade Marshall, your evaluation of General Alexeyev, if you please. Is Comrade Sergeyev correct in his assessment?
Bukharin looked uneasy.
Alexeyev is a young, bright officer, and yes, he has done fairly well at his present post.
But you wish to replace him with one of your own people?
Bromkovsky didn't wait for an answer.
It is amazing the things we learn and the things we forget. We forget that it is necessary for all Soviet citizens to share the burden together. But we remember the mistakes made in 1941, arresting good officers because their superiors erred, and replacing them all with political cronies who could lead us to disaster. If Alexeyev is a bright young officer who knows how to fight, why do you replace him?
Perhaps we were hasty, the defense minister admitted, watching the mood around the table shift dramatically.
I'll get you for this, Mikhail Eduardovich. If you wish to ally yourself with our oldest member, it is fine with me. He won't live forever. Neither will you.
That is decided, then, the party chairman said.
Next, Bukharin. What of the situation on Iceland?
There are reports that some enemy troops have landed, but we immediately attacked the NATO fleet. We are waiting now for an assessment of the losses we inflicted. We have to wait for satellite reconnaissance before we can be sure of that.
Bukharin knew only what Soviet losses were, and he would not reveal those until he could report favorable strike results.
Stendal, German Democratic Republic. They arrived just after dark, the KGB officers in battle dress. Alexeyev was working on deployments of newly arrived C divisions and didn't see them enter Sinkwest's office. 5 minutes later, he was summoned.
Comrade General Alexeyev, you are now Commander-in-Chief of the Western Theater of Military Operations, his superior said simply.
I wish you luck.
Alexeyev felt the hair rise up on his neck at the general's tone. The man was flanked by a pair of KGB colonels wearing the standard KGB battle dress, camouflage cloth tailored in the pattern of a Class A uniform, the State Security GB emblem shoulder boards. It was an institutional form of arrogance that suited the KGB as perfectly as the look on the colonels' faces.
What do I say? What can I do? This is my friend.
The former commander-in-chief of the Western Theater of Military Operations said it for him.
Goodbye, Pasha.
They took the general out. Alexeyev watched him go, then stop at the door. He turned with a look of hopeless fatalism before proceeding. Alexeyev's last sight was of the general's pistol belt, the leather flap loose over an empty holster. He turned away and saw on the desk a telex confirming his command status. It told him that he had the complete confidence of the party, the Politburo, and the people. He crumpled it and threw it against the wall. He had seen the same words on the same form a few brief weeks before. The recipient of that message of confidence was now in a car heading east.
How long do I have?
Alexeyev summoned his communications officer.
Get me General Beregovoy.
Brussels, Belgium.
Sakyur allowed himself a meal. He'd lost 10 pounds since the war had begun by subsisting on coffee and sandwiches and stomach acid.
Alexander had commanded armies in his teens and twenties. Maybe that's why he did so well, the general thought. He was young enough to stand it. It was working. The Cav was at Alfeld. The Germans were firmly in control of Gronau and Bruggen, and unless Ivan reacted quickly, his divisions on the Weser were in for a very nasty surprise. The door to his office opened. It was his German intelligence officer.
"Excuse me, Herr General, I have a naval intelligence officer here."
"Is it important, Joachim?"
"Yeah."
Sackyer looked down at his plate. "Show him in." The general was not impressed. The man was dressed in his shipboard khakis. Only a very sharp eye could see where the creases used to be.
"General, I'm Commander Bob Toland. Until a few hours ago, I was on the threat team with Strike Fleet Atlantic."
"How's it going on Iceland?"
"The air attack on the fleet was chewed up, sir. There's still the submarine problem to deal with, but the Marines are moving. I think we'll win this one, General."
"Well, the more subs they send after the carriers, the fewer go after my convoys."
"That's one way to look at it," Toland thought.
"Admiral, we captured a Russian fighter pilot. He comes from an important family. I interrogated him. Here's the tape. I think we know why the war started."
"Joachim, did you check his data?"
"No, sir. He has already briefed Comistland, and Admiral Beatty wanted the data to come directly to you."
Sackyer's eyes narrowed.
"Let's hear it, son."
"Oil."
Chapter 41. Targets of Opportunity. Brussels, Belgium. 3 copies were made of the tape. One went to one of Sackyer's intelligence staff for a separate translation to be checked against Toland's. Another was taken to French intelligence for electronic analysis. The third was analyzed by a Belgian psychiatrist who was fluent in Russian. While that was going on, half of the intelligence officers at NATO headquarters updated all their information about Soviet fuel consumption to date. CIA and other national intelligence services began a frantic investigation into Soviet oil production and utilization. Toland predicted the outcome hours before it came in. Insufficient data. The range of possible conclusions predicted that the Russians had enough fuel for several months, or had already run out. Sackyer took his time before accepting the data at face value. Prisoner interrogations had given his intelligence people a wealth of information, most of it patently false or contradictory. Since supply officers naturally lagged behind the fighting troops, few of them had been captured. It was the Air Force that bought the story first. They knew that enemy fuel supply dumps were smaller than expected. Instead of the one big facility so prevalent throughout Russian society, and after the big dump at Wittenberg had been blown up, the Russians had gone to small ones, accepting the price of increased air defense and security requirements. NATO's deep strike air missions had been concentrating on airfields, munitions dumps, transport junctions, and the tank columns approaching the front. More lucrative targets than the smaller-than-expected fuel depots, which were also harder to spot. The traffic signatures associated with the large fuel posts usually showed hundreds of trucks cycling in and out. The small ones, with fewer trucks involved, were harder for the look-down radar aircraft to locate. All these factors militated to a different targeting priority. After 15 minutes' discussion with his air chief, Sackyer changed all that. Stendal, German Democratic Republic.
"I can't do both things," Alexeyev whispered to himself.
He'd spent the last 12 hours trying to find a way, but it wasn't there. It was a marvel what it meant finally to be in command himself, no longer the aggressive subordinate. He was now responsible for success or failure. A mistake was his mistake. A failure was his failure. It had been much more comfortable the other way. Like his predecessor, Alexeyev had to mark his orders, even though his orders were impossible. He had to maintain the salient and continue the advance. He had the resources to do one or the other, but not both.
You will advance northwest from the Weser, cutting off the forces on the right flank of the advancing troops and preparing the way for a decisive attack into the Ruhr Valley. Whoever issued the orders either didn't know or didn't care that this was impossible. But NATO knew. Their air power had smashed convoys on every road between Rula and Alfeld. The two B-tank divisions guarding Beregovoy's northern flank had been caught off balance and routed. Battalion-sized blocking forces occupied the major crossroads while the NATO commanders reinforced the regiment at Alfeld. Probably two full tank divisions lurked in the forests north of Rula. But for the present, they had not attacked Beregovoy. Instead, their inaction both dared him to cross and invited him to counterattack north. Alexeyev remembered an important lesson from the Frunze Academy, the Kharkov Offensive of 1942. The Germans had allowed the advancing Red Army forces to penetrate deep, then cut them off and chewed them up. High command, meaning Stalin, ignored the objective realities of the situation, hence violating the second law of armed combat, concentrating instead on subjective perceptions of apparent progress that unfortunately proved false, the lesson concluded. The general wondered if this battle would be an object lesson for some future class of captains and majors, who would then write their test answers and essays in blue books, pointing out what an ass General Colonel Pavel Leonidovich Alexeyev was. Or he could pull them back, and admit defeat, and perhaps be shot, and then be remembered, if at all, as a traitor to the motherland. It was so fitting. After sending so many thousands of boys into fire, now he faced death as well, though from an unexpected direction. Major Sergeyev, I want you to go back to Moscow to tell them in person what I am up to. I am going to detach one division from Beregovoy and drive it east to open the way at Alfeld again. The attack on Alfeld will be from two directions, and after it succeeds, we will be able to continue the Weser crossing without fear of having our spearhead cut off. A skillful compromise, the major said hopefully.
That's just the thing I need to hear.
Bitburg, Federal Republic of Germany. 12 Frisbees were left. Twice they'd been pulled out of action briefly to determine what new tactics would lessen the hazards. With some success, Colonel Ellington told himself. A few of the Soviet systems had proved to have unsuspected capabilities, but half of his losses were unexplained. Were they the kind of accidents that accompanied flying heavily loaded aircraft at minimum altitude, or simply the laws of probability catching up with everyone? A pilot might think a 1% chance of being shot down on a given mission acceptable, then realize that 50 such missions made it a 40% chance. His flight crews were unnaturally quiet. The elite Frisbee squadron was a tight family of men, a third of whom were gone. The professionalism that allowed them to shut this out and do their weeping in private had its limits. That limit had been passed. Mission performance was down. But combat requirements were not, and Ellington knew that sentiment's place in the great military scheme of things fell below the need to hit targets. He rotated the aircraft off the pavement and headed east alone. Tonight he carried no weapons save sidewinders and anti-radar missiles for self-defense. His F-19A was burdened with fuel tanks instead of bombs. He settled to an initial flight altitude of 3,000 feet and checked his instruments, making a slight adjustment in the aircraft's trim before starting a slow descent to 500 feet. That was his altitude on crossing the Weser.
"Got some activity on the ground, Duke," Isley reported. "Looks like a column of tanks and troop carriers heading northeast on Highway 64.
"Report it in." In this sector, everything that moved was a target. A minute later, they crossed the Leine north of Alfeld. They could see the distant flashes of artillery, and Ellington banked left to keep clear. A 6-inch shell in its ballistic arc
didn't care if the Frisbee was invisible or not.
"This ought to be safer than a strike mission," Ellington told himself. They flew east, 2 miles from a secondary road that Isley kept under surveillance with their nose-mounted television camera. The threat warning receiver was lit up from SAM radars, sweeping the sky for intruders.
"Tanks," he said quietly. "Lots of them."
"Moving?"
"Don't think so. Looks like they're sitting alongside the road near the tree line."
"Wait, missile launch warning. SAM, 3 o'clock.
Ellington pushed the stick down and to the left. In a matter of seconds, he had to dive his aircraft one way, turn his head the other to see the incoming missile, then turn back to make sure he didn't plow a furrow in the dirt with his $50 million aircraft. All he saw of the SAM was a yellow-white gout of flame, and it was heading for him. As soon as he leveled out, he wrenched the Frisbee into a hard right turn. In the back, Isley had his eyes on the missile.
"Veering off, Duke."
"Yeah."
The missile leveled out at the treetops behind the F-19, then dipped and exploded in the woods.
"The instruments say that was an SA-6. The search radar is 1 o'clock and very close."
"Okay," Ellington said.
He activated a single sidearm anti-radar missile and fired it at the transmitter from a range of 4 miles. The Russians were slow to detect it. Ellington saw the detonation.
"Take that, Darth Vader."
"I think you're right on how they're getting us, Duke."
"Yeah."
The Frisbee was designed to defeat overhead radars. Something looking up had a much better chance of detecting them. They could defeat that by flying very low, but then they couldn't see as well as they wanted to see. He turned for another look at the tanks.
"How many you think, Don?"
"Lots, over 100.
"Tell 'em."
Ellington turned back north while Major Isley made his report. In minutes, some German Phantom jets would visit the tank assembly point. That many tanks sitting still probably meant a fueling point, he thought. Either the fuel trucks were already there, or they were en route. Fuel trucks were now his primary targets. A surprising change after weeks of going for supply dumps and moving columns.
"What's that?"
"Trucks dead ahead."
The Duke watched the enhanced view on his head-up display.
A long line of fuel trucks, traveling in a tight column, blacked out and moving fast. The curved metal tops made the identification easy. He turned the fighter again to circle 2 miles from the road. Isley's infrared picture showed the glow of engines and exhaust piping, hotter than the cool night air. It was like a procession of ghosts down the tree-lined road.
"I count 50 or so, Duke, and they're heading for that tank park."
5,000 gallons per truck, Ellington thought. 250,000 gallons of diesel fuel. Enough to fill every tank in 2 Soviet divisions. Isley called that one in also.
"Shade 3, the AWACS controller radioed back. "We have 8 birds en route. ETA 4 minutes. Orbit and evaluate."
Ellington did not acknowledge. He put his aircraft right down on the treetops for several minutes, wondering how many trees had Russian soldiers standing nearby with their SA-7 handheld missiles. A long time since he'd flown over Vietnam. A long time since he'd first realized that random chance could reach up into the sky and end his life, despite all his skill. His years of peacetime flying had allowed him to forget that. Ellington never thought an accident could kill him. But one man with an SA-7 could. And there was no way to know when he was flying over one.
"Stop thinking about that, Duke."
The Royal Air Force Tornadoes swept in from the east. The lead aircraft dropped his cluster bombs in front of the column. The rest swept over the road at a shallow angle, raining the bomblets on the convoy. Trucks exploded, sending burning fuel high into the air. Ellington saw the silhouettes of 2 fighter bombers against the orange flames as they headed west for home.
The fuel spread out on both sides of the road, and he watched the undamaged trucks stop and turn, desperately trying to escape the conflagration. Some were abandoned by their drivers. Others steered clear of the fire and tried to continue north. A few succeeded. Most bogged down, too heavily loaded to move on the soft earth. Tell them they got about half. Not bad at all. A minute later, the Frisbee was ordered northeast again. In Brussels, the radar signals downlinked from the ground search radar aircraft plotted the fuel convoy's path. A computer was now programmed to perform the function of the videotape recorder, and it traced the convoy's movements back to its point of origin. 8 more attack aircraft headed toward this patch of woods. The Frisbee got there first. "I show Sam radars, Duke," Isley said. "I'll call it one battery of SA-6 and another of SA-11. They must think this place is important." "And 100 little bastards with handheld SAMs," Ellington added. "ETA on the strike?" 4 minutes. 2 batteries of SAMs would be very bad news for the strike aircraft. Let's cut those odds down some. Isley singled out the SA-11 search acquisition radar. Ellington headed toward it at 400 knots, using a road to travel below the trees until he was 2 miles away. Another sidearm dropped off the airframe and rocketed toward the radar transmitter. At the same moment, 2 missiles came their way. The Duke applied maximum power and turned hard to the east, dropping chaff and flares as he did so. 1 missile went for the chaff and exploded harmlessly. The other locked onto the fuzzy radar signal reflected from the Frisbee and wouldn't let go. Ellington jinked up hard, then pulled the aircraft into a maximum G-turn in hope of outmaneuvering the missile. But the SA-11 was too fast. It exploded 100 feet behind the Frisbee. The 2 crewmen ejected from the disintegrating aircraft a moment later, their parachutes opening a scarce 400 feet off the ground. Ellington landed at the edge of a small clearing. He quickly detached himself from the chute and activated his rescue radio before drawing his revolver. He caught a glimpse of Isley's chute dropping into the trees and ran in that direction. "Fucking trees!" Isley said. His feet were dangling off the ground. Ellington climbed up and cut him down. The major's face was bleeding. Explosions thundered to the north. "They got it," Ellington said. "Yeah, but who's got us?" Isley said. "I hurt my back." "Can you move, Don?" "Hell yes." Stendal, German Democratic Republic. The dispersal of fuel reserves into small depots had reduced NATO attacks on them nearly to zero. The resulting sense of security had lasted nearly a month. The attacks on tank columns and munitions stores were serious, but there were plenty of replacements for both. Fuel was a different story. "Comrade General, NATO has changed its pattern of air attacks." Alexeyev turned from the map display to listen to his air intelligence officer. 5 minutes later, his supply chief came in. "How bad is it?" "Overall, perhaps as much as 10% of our forward supplies. In the Alfeld sector, over 30%. The phone rang next. It was the general whose divisions were to attack Alfeld in 5 hours. "My fuel is gone. The convoy was attacked and destroyed 20 kilometers from here." "Can you attack with what you have?" Alexeyev asked. "I can, but I won't be able to maneuver my units worth a damn." "You must attack with what you have." "But there are 4 divisions of Soviet soldiers who will die if you do not relieve them. The attack will go as scheduled." Alexeyev set the phone down. Beregovoy was also short on fuel. A tank could have enough fuel to drive 300 kilometers in a straight line, but they almost never traveled in a straight line. And despite orders, the crews invariably left the engines running when sitting still.
The time needed to start their diesels could mean death if a sudden air attack fell on them. Beregovoy had been forced to give all of his reserve fuel to his eastbound tanks so that they could hit Alfeld in conjunction with the westbound C divisions. The two divisions on the left bank of the Weser were essentially immobilized. Alexeyev was gambling the offensive on his ability to re-establish his supply routes. He told his supply chief to get more fuel. If his attack succeeded, he'd need more still. Moscow, RSFSR. The transition was ridiculous. Less than 2 hours from Stendal to Moscow by jet, from war to peace, from danger to safety. His father's chauffeur, Vitali, met him at the military airport and drove at once to the minister's official dacha in the birch forests outside the capital. He entered the front room to see a stranger with his father.
"So, this is the famous Ivan Mikhailovich Sergeyev, major of the Soviet Army."
"Excuse me, comrade, but I do not think we have met before."
"Vanya, this is Boris Kosov."
The young officer's face betrayed just a fraction of his emotions on being introduced to the director of the KGB. He leaned back into the easy chair and observed the man who had ordered the bombing of the Kremlin, after arranging for children to be there. It was 2 in the morning. KGB troops loyal, thought to be loyal, Minister Sergeyev corrected himself, to Kosov, patrolled outside to keep this meeting a secret.
"Ivan Mikhailovich," Kosov said genially, "what is your assessment of the situation at the front?"
The young officer suppressed a desire to look to his father for guidance. "The success or failure of the operation hangs in the balance. Remember that I am a junior officer and I lack the expertise for a reliable evaluation. But as I see things, the campaign could now go either way. NATO is short on manpower, but they've had a sudden infusion of supplies."
"About 2 weeks' worth."
"Probably less," Sergeyev said. "One thing we've learned at the front is that supplies get used up much faster than expected. Fuel, ordnance, everything seems almost to evaporate. So our friends in the Navy must keep hitting the convoys."
"Our ability to do this is seriously reduced," Kosov said. "I would not expect... The truth is that the Navy has been defeated. Iceland will soon be back in NATO hands."
"But Bukharin didn't say that,"
the elder Sergeyev objected.
"He didn't tell us that Northern Fleet's long-range aircraft were nearly exterminated either, but they were. The fool thinks he can keep me from learning this. The Americans have a full division on Iceland now, with massive support from their fleet. Unless our submarines can defeat this collection of ships, and remember that while they are there they cannot strike at the convoys, Iceland will be lost within a week. That will obviate the Navy's strategy for isolating Europe. If NATO can resupply at will, then what?"
Ivan Sergeyev shifted nervously in his chair. He could see where the conversation was leading.
"Then possibly we have lost."
"Possibly,"
Kosov snorted.
"Then we are doomed. We will have lost our war against NATO. We still have only a fraction of our energy needs, and our armed forces are a shadow of their former selves. And what will the Politburo do then?"
"But if the Alfeld offensive succeeds..."
Both Politburo men ignored this statement. "What of the secret German negotiations in India?" Minister Sergeyev asked.
"Ah, you noted that the foreign minister glossed over that."
Kosov smiled wickedly. He was a man born to conspiracy.
"They have not changed their bargaining position a dot. At most, it was a hedge against the collapse of NATO forces. It might also have been a trick from the beginning. We are not sure."
The KGB chief poured himself a glass of mineral water.
"The Politburo meets in 8 hours. I will not be there. I feel an angina attack coming on from my damaged heart."
"So Larionov will deliver your report?"
"Yes."
Kossoff grinned.
Poor Joseph. He is trapped by his own intelligence estimates. He will report that things are not going according to plan, but still going. He will say that NATO's current attack is a desperate attempt to forestall the Alfeld offensive, and that the German negotiations still hold promise. I should warn you, Major, that one of his men is on your staff. I know his name, but I have not seen his reports. It was probably he who provided the information that got the former commander arrested and put your general in his place.
What will happen to him? The officer asked.
That is not your concern, Kossoff answered coldly. A total of 7 senior officers had been arrested in the past 36 hours. All were now in Lefortovo prison, and Kossoff could not have altered their fates, even if he'd had the mind to.
Father, I need to know the fuel situation.
We are down to minimum national reserves. You have a week's fuel delivered or being shipped now, and roughly 1 week's supply is available for the forces deployed in Germany, plus a week for the armies detailed to go into the Persian Gulf. So tell your commander that he has 2 weeks to win the war. If he fails, it will mean his head. Larionov will blame the army for his own intelligence mistakes. Your life will be in danger too, young man.
Who is the KGB spy on our staff?
The theater operations officer. He was co-opted years ago, but his control officer is in the Larionov faction. I don't know exactly what he is reporting.
General Alexeyev is. Technically, he's violating orders by taking a unit on the Weser and sending it east to relieve Alfeld.
Then he is already in danger, and I cannot help him.
Not without tipping my hand.
Vanya, you should return now. Comrade Kossoff and I have other things to discuss.
Sergeyev embraced his son and walked him to the door.
He watched the red taillights disappear behind the birch trees.
I don't like using my own son in this.
Whom else can you trust, Mikhail Eduardovich? The Rodina faces possible destruction. The party leadership has gone mad, and I don't even have full control of the KGB. Don't you see? We have lost. We must now save what we can.
But we still hold enemy territory.
Yesterday does not matter. Today does not matter. What matters is 1 week from today. What will our defense minister do when it becomes obvious even to him that we have failed? Have you considered that? When desperate men realize they have failed, and those desperate men have control of atomic weapons, then what?
Then what indeed? Sergeyev wondered.
He pondered 2 more questions. What do we do about it? Then he looked at Kossoff and asked himself the second.
Alfeld, Federal Republic of Germany. The Russians were not responding very fast, McCall was surprised to see. There had been air attacks and several vicious artillery bombardments during the night, but the expected ground assault hadn't materialized. For the Russians, this was a crucial mistake. More ammunition had arrived, bringing them to full loads for the first time in weeks. Better still, a full brigade of German Panzer Grenadiers had reinforced the depleted troopers of the 11th Cav, and McCall had learned to trust these men as he trusted his tank's composite armor. Their defensive positions were arrayed in depth to the east and west. The armored forces pushing down from the north could now support Alfeld with their long-range guns. Engineers had repaired the Russian bridges on the Lina, and McCall was about to move his tanks east to support the mechanized troops guarding the rubble that was Alfeld. It was strange crossing the Soviet Ribbon Bridge. It was strange to be moving east at all, McCall thought. And his driver was nervous, crossing the narrow, flimsy-looking structure at 5 miles per hour. Once across, they moved north along the river, swinging around the town. It was raining lightly, with fog and low-hanging clouds, typical European summer weather that cut visibility to under 1,000 yards.
He was met by troops who guided the arriving tanks to selected defensive positions. The Soviets had helped for once. In their constant efforts to clear the roads of rubble, they'd given the Americans neat piles of brick and stone about 2 meters high, almost exactly the right size for tanks to hide behind. The lieutenant dismounted from his vehicle to check the placement of his four tanks, then conferred with the commander of the infantry company he was detailed to support. There were two battalions of infantry dug in deep and hard on the outskirts of Alfeld, supported by a squadron of tanks. He heard the overhead whistling of artillery shells, the new kind that dropped mines on the fog-shrouded battlefield ahead of him. The whistling changed as he mounted his tank. Incoming. Stendal, German Democratic Republic.
"It's taken too long to get them moving," Alexeyev growled to his operations officer.
"It's still three divisions, and they are moving now."
"But how many reinforcements have arrived?"
The operations man had warned Alexeyev against trying to coordinate a two-pronged attack, but the general had stuck to the plan. Beregovoy's A tank division was now in place to strike from the west, while the three C reserve divisions hit from the east. The regular tank force had no artillery. They'd had to move too fast to bring it. But 300 tanks and 600 personnel carriers were a formidable force all by themselves, the general thought. But what were they up against, and how many vehicles had been destroyed or damaged by air attack on the approach march?
Sergeyev arrived. His Class A uniform was rumpled from his traveling.
"And how was Moscow?" Alexeyev asked.
"Dark, Comrade General."
"The attack, how did it go?"
"Just starting now."
"Oh?" The major was surprised at the delay. He looked rather closely at the theater operations officer, who hovered over the map table, frowning at the dispositions while the plotting officers prepared to mark the progress of the attack.
"I have a message from High Command for you, Comrade General."
Sergeyev handed over an official-looking form. Alexeyev scanned it and stopped reading. His fingers went taut on the paper briefly before he regained self-control.
"Come to my office."
The general said nothing more until the door was closed.
"Are you sure of this?"
"I was told by Director Kossoff himself."
Alexeyev sat on the edge of his desk. He lit a match and burned the message form, watching the flame march across the paper almost to his fingertips as he twisted it in his hand.
"That fucking weasel!"
"Stukach!"
"An informer on my own staff."
"What else?"
Sergeyev related the other information he'd learned. The general was silent for a minute, computing his fuel requirements against fuel reserves.
"If today's attack fails, we've..."
He turned away, unwilling, unable to make himself say it aloud.
"I have not trained my whole life to fail."
He remembered the first notice he'd had of the campaign against NATO.
"I told them to attack at once. I told them that we needed strategic surprise, and that we'd have difficulty achieving it if we waited so long. I told them that we'd have to close the North Atlantic to prevent resupply of the NATO forces. So, now that we've accomplished none of these, my friend is in a KGB prison, and my own life is in jeopardy because I may fail to do what I told them we could not do. Because I was right all along."
"Come now, Pasha. Why should the Politburo listen to its soldiers when it can just as easily shoot them?"
The theater operations officer stuck his head through the door. "The troops are moving."
"Thank you, Yevgeny Ilyich,"
Alexeyev answered amiably. He rose from the desk.
"Come, Major, let's see how quickly we can smash through the NATO lines."
Alfeld, Federal Republic of Germany.
"Bar fight," Woody said from his gunner's position.
"Looks like it," McCall agreed.
They'd been told to expect 2 or 3 Soviet reserve divisions. Together they had perhaps the artillery strength of 2 regular units, and they were firing at both sides of the river. The miserable visibility hurt both sides. The Russians could not direct their artillery.